Marie Friedman Marquardt is a scholar in residence at Emory University's Candler School of Theology in Atlanta, Georgia. She is the co-author with three others of the book Living Illegal, The Human Face of Unauthorized Immigration, and she joins us now by phone. Marie, thank you so much for joining us on the Roadhouse and for taking time.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, I need to tell you, I really enjoyed the book. It is a topic that is difficult to deal with. It's difficult to read about, but I really did enjoy the book. The first thing I wanted to ask you is, you wrote this with three other people, all of you kind of coming from different segments of the population. How did the book come together like this?
Well, there were four of us who were authors of the book. Two of us are sociologists with a particular interest in religion, and the other two authors are political scientists. Mm-hmm. And the four of us have been doing research in various new immigrant communities, particularly in the Southeast, with Brazilians and Guatemalans and Mexicans for many, many years. And we worked together on a research project that initially had a pretty broad set of much more kind of theoretically based questions about globalization and issues of interethnic engagement. But because we were doing work kind of on the ground, in churches, in neighborhoods, in places of business that really had been affected significantly by rapid rates of immigration, changes in the ethnic configuration of their communities. And we found as we were doing this research, and then also as we were being invited to talk to groups around the country about immigration and what we were learning, there was so much misinformation and so many myths around unauthorized immigration in particular. And the unauthorized immigrants we got to know in these communities were really struggling with this basic issue of not being able to gain legal status in the U.S., that we came out of this long research project with sort of a different outcome than we had expected, and that was we really felt a strong need to write a book that would help to contribute to a more rational, reasonable discourse around unauthorized immigration.
And anything that would contribute to that, I think, is well worth doing, because there aren't many other issues. Well, I guess in this country, in this day and age, that's not true, having become polarized on just about everything, but certainly the issue of immigration is one of those, and I found it very interesting that again, the name of the book is Living Illegal. Illegal, I should point out, is in quotation marks. And there are a variety of phrases, some somewhat incendiary, I think, like illegal, that are used to describe immigrants in this country, particularly and from Latin America or the Southern Hemisphere, but such as undocumented. You use the one unauthorized. I can understand not using the word illegal because, you know, an act may be illegal, the person isn't. But why unauthorized rather than undocumented?
Yeah, we chose to, we use undocumented some in the text, and certainly we don't see major issues with using the term undocumented. Unauthorized actually is sort of more technically accurate in that the term reflects the reality that the immigrants the group of immigrants we're talking about are not authorized to live and work legally in the United States, although they may have documents, for example. Mm-hmm. They may have a passport, they may have a matricular identification card from their local consulate, you know, from the nation of origin consulate and other things. So it simply tries to call attention to this question of authorization and, frankly, how difficult it is to be authorized to live and work in the United States under our current federal immigration policy.
I found it particularly interesting as you talked about some of the reasons for the fact that people do come to this country, and you point out, as you did in your opening comments, that we're not just talking with people from Mexico, but also Guatemala and Brazil, whereas I think most people focus on those from Mexico. But what I'd like to do is kind of throw out some of the phrases or rationale that is used in this discussion and have you respond as to what the real truth is.
Okay.
For instance, you hear people say, you know, when we talk about the fact that perhaps we need a different kind of immigration policy in this country because we are, in fact, a nation of immigrants. You hear, well, of course, my folks or my grandparents immigrated from another country, wherever it might be, but they came here legally. Why can't they?
Yeah, so I think there are two important responses to that question. The first is based in history, and the second is based in a real thorough understanding of current immigration policy. So historically speaking, those of us whose grandparents or great-grandparents came to the United States during the last major wave of immigration, in which there are actually more, proportionally more immigrants living in the U.S. than there are now, there was not a distinction between legal and illegal or authorized and unauthorized immigrants until 1924. Before that time, if you came, you know, for example, my great-grandparents came through Ellis Island, they were checked to make sure that they were healthy, and if they could establish that they were healthy, they were allowed to kind of make their way on their own. Now, there were a few significant exceptions. There were specific laws targeting Chinese and Japanese, excluding entirely Chinese and Japanese immigrants. But otherwise, this distinction didn't exist. But I think more importantly, we have to think about this question. We hear so often, why don't they get in line? Why don't they fill out the paperwork, you know? Mm. I hear this so often when I talk to groups, and I think probably the most important thing we need to understand about the almost 11 million unauthorized immigrants living in the U.S. right now is that the overwhelming majority of them do not have a line to get into in the because of the way that our current immigration policy is configured. There is no pathway for them to be able to adjust their status from unauthorized to legally present in the U.S. And that is because of because the way that our system is currently configured, it's based on either work visas that your employer applies for on your behalf. And we know that the categories of work in which unauthorized immigrants are highly overrepresented, and where we need immigrant labor, it's clear. We have a shortage of native-born workers. Those visas are not being provided. So, for example, unskilled labor, which is a huge, broad category that includes a broad range of work, there are only 10,000 visas annually available. So while we know we have a greater demand, the people who fill that demand cannot get visas to work here short term. The second category is family reunification, which is first of all, you have to have an immediate family member apply on your behalf. And secondly, and probably more importantly, the lines for family reunification, for example, a spouse and minor children of a permanent legal resident, someone who's certified, authorized to live and work here, if that spouse and those minor children are from Mexico, the wait times in the last decade have been approximately 10 to 12 years just to be able to live with your spouse.
Mm-hmm. Who is, in fact, an authorized?
Right, who has done everything according to the proper procedures.
We're visiting with Marie Friedman Marquardt, one of the co-authors of Living Illegal, The Human Face of Unauthorized Immigration. Second thing I'm going to throw at you is, well, you know, they just want to come here because the economics in their own country are so bad. Why should we have to pay for the fact that Mexico is in bad economic condition?
Yeah, that's another question I hear so often. And, of course, we can expand that out globally. And we can ask, of course, Mexicans do comprise the majority of unauthorized immigrants living in the United States right now. We have a long migration history with Mexico. And frankly, if we look back at that long migration with history with Mexico, we can see that patterns of migration cannot be explained simply by poverty or economic instability or political corruption in one country and prosperity or political security in another. What instead, the way that we can make sense of global patterns of migration is if we think about the fact that when relationships are built between nation states, either political or economic or military relationships, those build bridges across which migrants travel. We have done, our team of researchers have done research not only here in the United States, but also in sending communities in Mexico, Brazil, and Guatemala. And what we've found is that particularly as those communities have opened in the past couple of decades to free trade agreements and to really new economic configurations, the local economies have been changed in such a way that it's impossible for those communities to exist without migration, without people migrating and sending money back to their place of origin.
Can I interrupt you just for a sec?
Yes, of course.
Because that's what I wanted to ask you about. I've heard, and you cite this too, that economic policies that the United States, we may not have originated, but we certainly participate in things like the North American Free Trade Alliance, the Central America Free Trade, which was touted to be not only great for this country, but great for the countries that we were establishing the agreement with, you say is not the case for for workers in Mexico. Why not? What has happened because of those agreements to make it more attractive for people there to leave, to come here to work?
Yeah, and to make it, in fact, a necessity for them to leave many rural communities. So when these free trade agreements are established, what happens is that I can give a very specific example of a small town where I've done research about an hour outside of Mexico City that was, prior to about in the mid-1980s, a farming community where people had their land. They farmed corn primarily, and they sold the corn, and they were able to subsist. Well, before NAFTA came, there were some changes in the U.S. subsidizing corn production here and other things that made their capacity to subsist on selling corn really no longer possible. And so those agrarian workers began to migrate to seek work. They would migrate to, say, Mexico City or another big city. And then those cities and their surroundings were being really radically transformed economically by U.S. investment, U.S. building factories or plants, where these workers could find jobs. But many of these, and there's a lot of research that's kind of shown this pattern, many of these places of employment, first of all, took them out of local communities so that these local economies began to really not exist any longer. So migration had to happen. And then when they migrated to a factory or to work, let's say, in a textile plant, oftentimes this work was very, very, very strenuous, and people would work in these jobs for a couple of years, and then they would be fired if they got older or something along those lines, and another set new crop of workers would come in. Well, those laid off workers now kind of perceive migration as migration to the United States as a possibility. Of course, if you're making $1 a day making a pair of jeans that you know are going to be sold for $75 in the United States, it certainly makes it imaginatively possible, whereas it hadn't been before. And also it becomes a necessity to find work that will allow you to continue to send money back to your home community, to your elderly parents, to support your children, and other things. So these migration patterns become really a necessity as a way to deal with the disruptions in the local economy that have resulted from the opening of these communities to free trade.
Sure. I want to ask you a question that hopefully has a short answer and then one that maybe has a longer one. But
okay.
As of September of 2011, the Obama administration has deported well over 1 million people. How does that number compare with what the Bush administration did?
So the Obama administration is on track and certainly will meet this target to deport as many people in 1 4-year term as the Bush administration deported in 2 4-year terms.
Okay. And yet, when interviewed, President Obama talks about the fact that he's got to talk to the American people, he's got to engage the Republicans to get them to vote. I'm talking specifically about the DREAM Act, to do what's right. So he's saying one thing, but his administration is doing another. Why?
Yes, so this is a question that we are very concerned about and that I think we all ought to be concerned about. The Obama administration's strategy has been to sort of double down on enforcement. And the intention of this, not only with significantly increased deportations, but also with significantly increased resources toward border enforcement, which you might not think is the case considering what we're hearing, but in fact the Obama administration has increased border enforcement from $9 to $17 billion by 2010. And the purpose of this was really to establish or to sort of earn the political capital that Obama believed would be necessary for Republicans to come to the table for comprehensive immigration reform, not only the DREAM Act, but an immigration reform package that would repair this broken immigration system that we're all sort of suffering under currently. Clearly, this is not this strategy has not played out in the way that Obama wished. And now not only do we have virtually no hope for comprehensive federal immigration reform, but even the DREAM Act has become this political hot-button issue, whereas in the Republican primaries, for certain, we know 70% of Americans last time the DREAM Act came up for a vote in 2010 supported this because they realized that children who didn't make the decision to migrate here should have the opportunity to adjust their status.
And very briefly, what does the DREAM Act, what are the provisions of the DREAM Act?
Yeah, so what the DREAM Act would do, basically, is that it would provide an opportunity for people who were brought here as children to the United States, arrived before the age of 15, completed high school or an equivalent, and either serve in the military for 2 years or attend college or university for 2 years, to have a sort of provisional legal status. And if they meet several other requirements over the course of the next, the way that it was has been written, is, I believe, 6 years, then they can adjust that to permanent residency. And the DREAM Act, again, it has broad public support. Last time it went up for a vote in December of 2010, it had broad support in the House of Representatives, a majority in the Senate, but not enough to overcome a filibuster. The DREAM Act needs to be passed. We have 65,000 students a year graduating from U.S. high schools, ready and willing to contribute fully to the life of the nation and barred from doing so.
I'm going to throw one other question at you, and then as far as myths, or at least what you hear very popularly, that unauthorized immigrants to this country are stealing jobs from American workers and are a drain on our welfare system, our healthcare system, and don't pay any taxes and contribute nothing to this country.
So that's really, I think that's there's a two-part response to that.
Well, probably more.
Yeah. I'll try to narrow it down to two. I'll try to narrow it down to two. One of the misconceptions about unauthorized immigrants is that they receive all of these services and they don't pay taxes. In fact, unauthorized immigrants use significantly less services than their native-born counterparts because they're not eligible for any services except for public elementary education and emergency health care. And unauthorized immigrants pay a broad range of taxes. So we know state by state, if you look at state data on this, that unauthorized immigrants are paying more in taxes than they're receiving in services. And then, you know, there are other ways. For example, unauthorized immigrants who are paying payroll taxes pay into Social Security and never receive the benefits from that. There's a $7 to $10 billion reserve fund that Social Security has annually for these payments into Social Security that unauthorized immigrants pay and will not receive. So that's the first point. Unauthorized immigrants clearly are paying more in taxes than they're receiving in services. Secondly, the stealing jobs. You know, I think where this really, the rubber hits the road on this, is I'm in Georgia, and the state recently states, Georgia and Alabama and other states following Arizona, have passed these very, very harsh, punitive, anti-immigrant laws that have made immigrants not terribly willing to locate themselves in Georgia or Alabama. And, you know, in Georgia, a law was passed in the spring of 2011. Georgia passed a law, HB 87. Within weeks of that law being passed, in early June, the Georgia Growers Association, this is farm growers, owners of farms, reported a shortage of 11,080 farm workers. They had blueberries, you know, on the vines, ready to be picked, that were rotting, and they could not find native-born workers to fill those jobs, even in a period in Georgia when we had about 10% unemployment. We also find again and again when a poultry processing plant or something along those lines, there's a raid on the plant, their unauthorized workers are forced to leave, they seek native-born workers, they can't find them, they end up having to close down their plant or radically reduce production. There are sectors of our economy that continue to rely on unauthorized workers, really a quarter of the workers in many sectors of our economy are unauthorized workers. This is not to say it's a good system to have unauthorized workers, but clearly we need immigrant workers in the United States.
Right. And we're running out of time, and I've got so much more to ask you, but more and more states seem to be passing, and nationally, as you listen to the election posturing and all the rest of it, everybody seems to want to get tough on immigration and tough on unauthorized immigrants and so forth. And yet you said that the DREAM Act at one point in time had like 70% favorable. Are the people that are making political decisions or running for political office really reflective of what this country believes, or are they simply playing to a very small base?
I would say the latter, and that's really based on our research. We did research in some of the communities that are considered the harshest anti-immigrant communities in the nation. And when we got on the ground in those communities and started talking to citizens, particularly citizens who had had the opportunity either in their churches or their workplaces or their schools to really get to know unauthorized immigrants, and then who had good information to allow them to understand the problem of unauthorized immigration, they certainly did not reflect these loud, harsh, anti-immigrant voices. Mm-hmm. And I want to say that these state laws that are having such devastating effects on our states, not only on immigrants in our states, but on the states more broadly, these state laws are being written and promoted by people who do not live in those states. There's an organization called FAIR that has been very involved in a particular person, in fact, who's the state attorney of Kansas, a man named Chris Kobach. And he goes state by state, community by community, seeking communities that he thinks might be amenable because of this bass, this loud bass voice, to passing these laws. They write the laws and give them to the states, and then the states attempt to get them passed. Then the states have to deal with the fallout, and they're back in Washington, D.C. or Kansas or wherever they've come from.
Sure.
And these laws, particularly these laws that revolve around this concept that we're going to hear more and more about because many of our presidential hopefuls are talking about it, this concept of self-deportation, these have devastating effects on communities, not only on immigrants in communities, but on communities more broadly.
I also want to ask you, I'm afraid that's going to be another conversation about what does appropriate immigration reform look like? Because everybody agrees, no matter which side of the screaming that you're on, is that the system is broken.
Right.
But I'm not too sure very many people can agree on how to fix it. But I'm afraid that's probably going to have to wait for another time.
I certainly hope that your listeners will kind of seek answers to those very important questions.
One of the ways you can do it is to read the book. Living Illegal, The Human Face of Unauthorized Immigration. We have been visiting with one of the co-authors, Marie Friedman Marquardt from Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Marie, I want to thank you very much for taking the time. First of all, for writing the book. Secondly, for all your work on this issue. And finally, for being with us. We really appreciate the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care.